Good. Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk today. First of all, I'll start with a warning. Just like my daughter's favorite book, there's a monster at the end of this talk. But just like in my daughter's favorite book, it's a friendly, fuzzy, furable, very lovable monster like Grover. Dad, do you guys recognize this? I gave a talk once, and not a single person actually had ever seen this book. You haven't been born in the 70s, I guess. Okay, so I'm going to be talking primarily about work that came out earlier this year with Alex Bellin and Christoph Keller. But I will also take the opportunity to insert various advertisements during my talk for other papers to appear. One follow-up paper with Alex and Christoph, another paper with Paul Delage and Eric Ferlinde, another paper with Simon Ross, and finally, at the end, if I have time, I'll discuss hopefully some work with Shamit Katra and Greg Moore, which I think is a little more preliminary. Okay. The question which I'm like to address today, although I won't, of course, answer it completely, is the question of which classical theories of gravity can be quantized. And the strategy that I'd like to try and use is to understand this in a relatively simple setting, namely three-dimensional gravity, and to use the ADS-CFT correspondence, which relates three-dimensional theories of gravity in asymptotically anti-de-Sitter space to two-dimensional CFTs. So, according to the ADS-CFT dictionary, every two-dimensional CFT can be interpreted as a theory of gravity in three-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space, and vice versa. And here, I'm just reminding you of a few of the features of that dictionary. So for an ADS theory of gravity, we have two-dimensional coupling constants, the ADS radius and Newton's constant, which can be combined into a dimensionless ratio, L over G, which is the size of the ADS space in Planck units. And this corresponds to the central charge of the dual two-dimensional conformal field theory. States in the ADS theory of gravity are labeled by their energy, which here I'm measuring in ADS units to get something dimensionless. And that dimensionless energy then corresponds to the dimension of the state or the corresponding operator in the conformal field theory. Now, for three-dimensional ADS gravity, unlike in flat space, there is a gap in the spectrum. So the lightest black hole states in the theory don't have energy zero, but instead have an energy which is greater than that of empty anti-de-Sitter space by a finite amount set by Newton's constant. And in the dual CFT language, what this means is that the states in the CFT that correspond to black holes are those states with relatively high dimension as compared to the central charge of the theory. So if, when we study this conformal field theory, we wish to distinguish between perturbative states from the gravity point of view and black hole states, the perturbative states will be those with low dimension compared to the central charge, and the black hole states will be those with a large dimension compared to the central charge.
Alex, how do you define the dimension of the state?
It's the conformal, the scaling dimension. So if you think about it as an operator.
If it's an operator.
So in a CFT, there's a state operator correspondence. And so states can be characterized by their scaling dimension. So in terms, yeah.
For example, if I had a thermal state.
Oh, here, of course, so a thermal state is, so here I'm thinking about microcanonical ensemble. So I'm organizing states. These are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, L0 plus L0 bar, which is the generator of conformal transformations. Of course, the thermal state breaks conformal invariants, so you shouldn't think of it. You should think of that as an ensemble of states which have many different energies. Just like in any theory.
I mean, I think it would be okay if you just put the expectation value delta.
Sure.
Make sure delta squares.
Sure. I mean, so for example, at very high temperature, there's some sort of you know, the canonical ensemble and microcanonical ensemble are indistinguishable. And so there would be some dev of the energy. But really, you should think of a finite temperature state as some mixed state with support on many different energy eigenstates.
Alex, you're also using delta to represent the whole tower, right? The full representation generated by the project.
So I haven't been terribly specific here. Yes, so by a black hole state, we really usually think of those as primary states in the CFT. And then the descendant states built on top of that, well, descendant states in the bulk point of view are essentially gravitons. So you would think of a primary state as a black hole, for example, or as some sort of new degree of freedom, and descendant states as a set of gravitons, or what are called boundary gravitons, dressed on top of this black hole state, for example. Okay.
Sorry, I have one more question. Okay. So in Arrhenius 3 and string theory, mm-hmm. we do actually have 10D black holes, which have energy smaller than that value.
So for example, there can be all sorts. So these are the three-dimensional black holes. So these are the BTC black holes. But of course, there can be all sorts of states which have energy below this bound.
Okay, would the 10D black holes be primary operators as well, or can they be tailed away?
Generically, you expect primary operators. I mean, it's very, very hard, as many of you probably know, to find theories with no primary operators in this window. And to some extent, that's the point of the talk.
I thought those could Hawking evaporate. Maybe I'm confused.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they will. So they'll be in superposition.
No, okay. So they're not inside diagonal. Yeah.
So this was intended to be the least controversial slide. Maybe I can continue.
Well, they dominate the microcanonical ensemble at those at energies below that. So that's why I was confused why we don't talk, why you stop talking about black holes at that point when we have extra dimensions.
Let's just not have extra dimensions.
We're going to have, well, okay. let's not have extra dimensions for this slide. Okay, we get this?
Right.
Okay. I was joking when I said that it would take 60 minutes, but now I'm not. Okay. So what sort of approach could we take in order to try and analyze gravity in ADS3? Well, one approach, and this is not the approach that I'm largely going to be taking today, but one approach which many people have taken in the past is to just try and quantize three-dimensional gravity, possibly plus some matter fields, in anti-de Sitter space directly. So the sorts of computations that one can imagine trying to do are computations, for example, of the torus partition function of the theory by doing some sort of Euclidean path integral and summing over geometries. And then you could ask whether that torus partition function takes the form of trace q to the L0 times q bar L0 bar, where you trace over some good-looking Hilbert space. For example, you might want to demand that the coefficients and the expansion and powers of q are all positive integers. That would be a feature of a nice Hilbert space. And if you try and do this computation, making some sort of reasonable assumptions about what the path integral of 3D gravity looks like, then, at least when you include just gravity, general relativity, the answer is that one only finds a result that looks like a nice Hilbert space when the central charge is of order 1. And in these cases, the torus partition function matches some known conformal field theories. For example, in a paper that I wrote with Tom and some other friends, we found examples that looked like minimal model CFTs, and some earlier work with Son and Strominger, we found that chiral gravity looked like the monster conformal field theory when C was 24. And there are a few other sort of examples like this. And so because of this, you might expect, or you might suspect, that pure theories of gravity, that is to say, theories of gravity that only include, say, the graviton and some finite number of other degrees of freedom, only exist for some discrete sporadic values of the coupling constant, or for some values of the cosmological constant that are finite or order 1 in Planck units.
By pure gravity, are you assuming somehow you still have the issue of what the microstates would be? I mean, you have these
yes.
black hole configurations.
So I'm not constructing the Hilbert space directly. Okay. If you want me to offer some speculations on that, I could. But in this calculation that I'm sort of alluding to here, we're only doing sort of the torus partition function calculation, which computes the spectrum for you but does not tell you what the states are.
Well, what is your definition of pure gravity?
Well, I was careful not to define it precisely because I don't have a precise definition.
But wouldn't you want to say that any theory of gravity with a large gap in the spectrum know, some kind of ubiquitous completion of
yes.
Einstein gravity.
Yes.
But then it seems to be extremely unlikely that they exist only in quantum mechanics or the web, because who knows what happens at Planck scale.
Okay, well, so, for example, if the gap is of order Planck scale, then you could interpret these as black hole states. Because
yes.
the gap in the energy spectrum is, so, I
yes,
would...
But the your prescription to compute
yes.
a partition function certainly is a far stronger, made far stronger assumptions than just this.
No, that's absolutely right. So I think one interesting thing to try and do would be to construct conformal field theories with large gaps, or with sparse spectrums, as I'll describe for you in a second. You know, if I think a very interesting thing to do would be to construct a family of conformal field theories where the gap in the spectrum grows with central charge. Okay. If it grows linearly with central charge, then you have a good case for saying that that's a pure theory of gravity. But no one's ever been able to construct such a theory. Okay. And so, you know, because no one has been able to construct such a theory, it's tempting to speculate that the reason why we can't construct such a theory is not that we're stupid, but that such theories don't exist. So
but it's hard to construct any CFT that is not, let's say, either rational or can be constructed by something like time margin deformation. I mean, we think that there are a lot more CFTs than we can actually explicitly construct.
That's true. That's true. Okay. So yes. So I mean, I said that you know, I said perhaps here. Okay. I don't think you know. I think it's an open question. One new result, however, that I'm not going to talk about today, but I just want to advertise, is that if you try and generalize this calculation to study not just the torus partition function, but the partition function on other non-orientable Riemann surfaces, then it appears that even in these very, very simple cases, such as those that Tom and I had studied earlier, you have to include orbifold singularities. So you have to include particle-like states in the theory in order to correctly reproduce the partition functions of these various minimal models. So what that means is that even though you thought you were studying just a theory of gravity, in order to get everything to work out to match with the conjectured dual conformal field theory, you have to include other states in the theory, things that look like they have new degrees of freedom associated with them.
So you call these non-smooth saddles particles because you can get them by sticking in Wilson lines?
I call them particles because I get them by sticking in orbifold singularities. By including geometries with orbifold singularities in the path integral. In 3D gravity, you know, a conical deficit and orbifold singularity is what looks like a particle. Okay.
And they're definite orbifold? Some definite class of orbifold?
That's correct. Yeah.
And those don't contribute to the other calculations?
They don't contribute to the other calculations.
Sorry, so I mean, you had this earlier problem with Ed, even at the level of the torus at large C.
Yeah, that was at large C.
Yeah, but so then you don't know where if you... It's an obvious task, but that could also be fixed by including things like this.
And as far as we know, there doesn't seem to be a simple way of adding a finite number of particle-like degrees of freedom to do this. Okay. If you add an infinite number of degrees of freedom, you can kind of do whatever you want. Okay.
But even in the case of torus, there are other candidate geometries. For example, the, you can have a cusp.
That's right. That's right.
And that contribution could be there. That's not something we have.
I mean, we can discuss that later. I mean, again, if you add a cusp, you know, that's like adding new particle degrees of freedom.
Okay.
Maybe I'm not quite. So yes,
not really.
In order to try and.
It's a smooth geometry with same asymptotes.
Well, you've removed the point.
You have to put
some boundary conditions.
I even would say it's not a solution, right?
No, why do you say it's not a solution? I mean, the volume, the regularized energy field acting perfectly fine. I'm not changing the exponential growing part. I'm adding something that's.
Well, you have to impose some boundary conditions at the cusp. Maybe this is not what I was planning on talking about today. So maybe we can defer this. Okay. Good. Or by defer, I mean not talk about it. good. So what I really would like to try and do is not study the bulk theory of gravity directly, but instead try and understand semi-classical gravity. And I'd like to do so by considering a family of conformal field theories labeled by some parameter n, which has a large central charge limit, so that when you take n to infinity, c goes to infinity, and you have some semi-classical theory of gravity. Remember, the central charge is the coupling constant of the bulk theory. So what I'd like to do is try and understand, study general families of conformal field theories, and try and ask how to think about them as bulk theories of gravity. So the simplest thing that you could look at is the spectrum of a theory, say theory n, as a function of delta. And we know that when delta is very large compared to the central charge, we'll get Carty growth, just because of Carty's formula. And this reproduces the black hole entropy formula in three-dimensional ABS. Instead, what I would like to do is not look at the black hole sector of the theory, but look at the perturbative states in the gravity theory. And I'll do that by studying this density of states when the dimension delta, the energy, is small compared to the central charge. Okay? So, for example, you could imagine in this family of conformal field theories, keeping delta fixed and sending C to infinity. Or having delta scale with C in some way so that delta stays less than C in the large central charge limit. So if I hand you a family of CFTs, you can study this density of states. And you could ask what this density of states looks like and then try and interpret that density of states from the bulk point of view. So if you find that the log of the density of states grows like the square root of the energy, then that is the characteristic growth of gravitons, boundary gravitons, in three-dimensional anti-de-Sayer space. One comment I'll make is that this looks a lot like Carty's formula, because you have a square root of delta. But the difference is that in Carty's formula, the coefficient is proportional to the central charge. But for graviton states, the coefficient is proportional to 1 rather than the central charge. It's of order 1. So this density of states is actually the characteristic growth in the density of states of a two-dimensional field theory. And that's because the graviton states in anti-de-Sitter space are localized at the boundary. And so they have the characteristic growth of a theory in two dimensions rather than three dimensions. They're usually called boundary gravitons or topological gravitons for that reason. If you have a theory with a local degree of freedom, say quantum field theory in three-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space, then you would get a slightly higher growth in the density of states. Again, where delta naught is of order 1. And that, so this, for example, would be the characteristic growth of a scalar field in anti-de-Sitter space. Or if you imagine some compactification down to ADS3 on some space M, whose volume stays fixed as you take large central charge, then you would get a more rapid growth in the density of states. However, for all of the simplest conformal field theories that we think have ADS duals, you actually, in fact, find a much more rapid growth in the density of states. What you find is that the density of states has Hagedorn behavior, where this parameter delta naught sets the Hagedorn temperature. And this is the characteristic behavior of a string theory. And the parameter delta naught, the Hagedorn temperature, then sets the string length.
What if the theory is an M theory where there are no string theory?
Well, in that case, if you fix the size of the compactification manifold as you take the semi-classical limit, you would get this answer here with d equal to 11.
But that could also be a consistent spectrum.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
But you left out the 10D black holes.
Okay.
It says delta much less than C.
Yeah. So
you do have delta much less than C. You dominate all the way to delta over C. Is there an inverse power over C?
Do you mean delta minus C is one of the
states? No, they can have a mass of...
There's some dimension for which the string states dominate. That's where you see this.
Yeah.
The string scale, which is...
I think that depends on couplings, whether that dominates.
Yeah.
But the black hole...
I mean, I'm taking a semi-classical C goes to infinity limit. So you could just as easily call these strings black holes at the correspondence.
For weakly coupled string theory, there is a regime where the strings...
Yeah, that's true. But they would have a different density of states.
Right. I didn't say that this was a complete list of all possible densities of states that you could find. I said this was a list of a possible density of states.
You're implicitly assuming that rho n of delta is insensitive to n when delta is much less than c.
Good. Okay. Thank you for that question. So, of course, we can't just take any random family of conformal field theories with a large central charge limit. We have to impose some constraints on this family of conformal field theories. And our strategy is to find some natural set of constraints to impose on the family of conformal field theories, and then understand what the implications of that set of constraints are going to be for these densities of states. So the most basic requirement that I could imagine imposing is the one that she just asked about, which is that what we want to demand is that when you take the n goes to infinity limit, keeping the energy of the state fixed, then the density of state should become insensitive to n, large n. And moreover, I'd like to demand that it's finite, simply because this quantity, which I'm calling rho infinity, is precisely the semi-classical spectrum in the limit where I send Newton's constant to zero. And I'd like to demand that the number of states below a given energy remains finite in this semi-classical limit. And the result that I want to advertise today is that at least for a very simple case, a very, very simple family of conformal field theories, imposing this condition is enough to imply that the density of states will become Hagedorn. Okay? So this is not necessarily something that we expect for a general family of conformal field theories, but arbitrary two-dimensional conformal field theories are very hard to study. So the strategy that I'm describing today is one where we just focus on a simple family of conformal field theories and understand what the constraints of having a well-defined large central charge limit imply for the density of states of the theory. Okay. So it's tempting to speculate that we can draw lessons for this for more general families of conformal field theories. So perhaps it's the case that theories with only a finite number of local degrees of freedom in ADS exist only in sort of sporadic cases when the central charge is of order one, and that all of the generic theories of quantum gravity with a semi-classical limit have an infinite number of degrees of freedom. So for example, this Hagedorn density you could try and interpret as associated with some spectrum of extended objects. I don't think we have any incredibly strong evidence one way or the other, but at the very least, for a very simple family of conformal field theories, we see that just imposing a well-defined large central charge limit does constrain the spectrum of the theory. Okay. So what's the family that I would like to talk about? Well, let's first ask how it is we can construct a general family of conformal field theories with large central charge. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to begin with some seed conformal field theory. It can just be your favorite conformal field theory of fixed central charge. And then I'd like to take n copies so that the central charge is now n times the central charge of your seed theory. Now, of course, this has far too many states for what I call rho infinity to remain finite in the large n limit. It has of order. So here, I've just written down a simple example of a candidate partition function. And you can see that it has of order n states at dimension 1, of order n squared states at dimension 2, and so on and so forth. However, we can take advantage of the fact that this theory has a large global symmetry. The global symmetry is Sn, the set of permutations of the n field theories. And what we would like to do is to project onto the singlet sector of some subgroup of that permutation symmetry. And if you think about it, the only way to project onto the singlet sector of some global symmetry and still have a local stress tensor is if you gauge the symmetry. And this is really why holographic conformal field theories are gauge theories. The only way to project onto the singlet sector of some large symmetry group, of some symmetry group, and to still have some local dynamics is if you gauge that symmetry. In the case of two dimensions, what do we mean by gauge? Well, what we mean is orbifold. We're talking about a discrete symmetry, and so you project onto the singlet sector of that symmetry, and you have to add new states, which are the twisted sector states, in order for the theory to be consistent. And so what we end up with is a landscape of very simple theories, of very simple conformal field theories, one for each choice of permutation group G, that's some subgroup of the full symmetric group.
And its modular invariance is still guaranteed when you do this projection?
Well, if you do the projection without adding twisted states, then modular invariance is not guaranteed.
So you're
the purpose of the twisted states is to restore modular invariance.
So you're including the twisted
states. Yes.
I'm sorry, Alex, this condition that rho singlet or the perturbative states are finite as n goes to infinity, is that precluding a compact manifold that blows up as you take the ADS?
Indeed.
So you're insisting on the compact manifold staying finite sizes?
Absolutely. OK. And so what's the basic idea? The basic idea is that you introduce twisted states, and that as you scan over all possible gauge groups, over all possible orbifold groups, you need the orbifold group to be big in order to project out enough states to keep rho infinity finite. And it turns out that it has to be so big that the twisted states lead you to a Hagedorn density of states. So there have been enough questions that I won't go through the proof of that. You can sort of imagine how it goes just by staring at this formula here. You can see that in order to project out the states at energy 1, the size of the group has to be at least n, because there's order n states here. At energy 2, the size of the group has to be at order n squared, and so on and so forth. So it has to be a pretty big group.
Zach, I just make one comment. So when you say construct generic large CFTs, you really mean construct a very special class of large CFTs.
Right. I mean, essentially, these are free conformal field theories, in a sense which I'll make, in a sense which I'll make precise.
Okay. And similarly, I would say why some sets of holographic CFTs are gauge theories.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, obviously, it would be much more interesting to study more interesting theories, but these are the theories for which we can make interesting statements right now. Okay. And so I won't go through the proof, but roughly speaking, the idea is contained in this picture here. So we scan over possible gauge groups. So here, the orbifold group is getting more complex as we move to the right here. And then if the orbifold group is too small, you just have an infinite number of states in the singlet sector. And but you have no states in the twisted sector. As you increase the complexity of the group, the singlet sector gets simpler, but the twisted sector gets more complicated. And if you work it out, it turns out that the twisted sector will always have at least a Hagedorn density of states with a Hagedorn temperature that's of order 1 in ADS units. So these would be theories where the string scale is equal to the ADS scale. Okay, so moreover, you can study the correlation functions in the theory. And it turns out that in the large n limit, these correlation functions will generally factorize in the sense that any correlation function will be a sum of Witt contractions plus corrections that are suppressed in the large n limit. However, in order to get this large n factorization, we need to impose some additional conditions on our permutation groups. In particular, what we need to do is demand that this permutation group acts democratically in a sense that we can make precise, but that I don't want to go through in too much detail. So what it means is that in a sense, in the large n limit for all of these theories, in the bulk, they just look like some sort of generalized free field theory, plus some corrections that will depend in more detail on the seed conformal field theory and the choice of permutation group. So I think I'll skip through the proof. But roughly speaking, the idea is that if you look, the idea is that you first demand here. The idea is that you first demand that the singlet sector partition function, that the singlet sector density of states is finite. And that implies that if you think of the cycle decomposition of an element in this permutation group, well, actually, maybe I'll say one or two more words. The essential idea is that the untwisted sector partition function is determined by the statistics of the elements of your permutation group G. In particular, any element of your permutation group can be decomposed as the product of a bunch of cycles in Sn. And it's the statistics on the space of cycles that determines whether your untwisted sector partition function is finite. So in particular, one of the things that you can show is that in the large n limit, the average number of I cycles for any finite number of I for an element of your group has to remain finite. So for example, for the symmetric group, the average number of I cycles is 1 over I. Okay. The average number of two cycles in a random permutation is 1/2. For a general permutation group, in order for rho infinity to be finite, those numbers can be different, but they have to remain finite. And if you think about it for a second, the only way that this can happen is if there are cycles of arbitrarily large length in the large n limit. Okay. But once you have cycles of arbitrarily long length, you can think about the twisted sectors associated with those cycles, and that immediately leads you to a Hagedorn density. The idea is that when you're in a twisted sector, the spectrum looks like a conformal field theory with a central charge that's larger by a factor of I, where you twist by a cycle of length I. And so you have Bacardi growth in that sector. But the full density of states is found by summing over all possible twisted sectors that the states could come from. And that's dominated by a saddle where the size of the twist I depends on the energy of the state that you're looking at. So for example, as you look at a higher and higher energy state, the typical state of that energy will be a twisted state with a length, with a twist length that's proportional to the density, to the energy of that state. And so if you just look at that saddle point, that gives you a Hagedorn growth. Now, of course, the size of the twist can't be bigger than n. So that means that if you look for states with dimension much larger than n, much larger than the central charge, then in fact you don't get this Hagedorn density of states. Instead, you go back to the Cardi regime. So there is a regime where you have a Hagedorn density of states, but when the dimension is large compared to the central charge, that is to say, when you're with states that you would interpret as black holes in the bulk, that Hagedorn density goes over to a Cardi density of states. So the Hagedorn transition is the Hawking-Page phase transition in these theories. Good. Let me just talk in a bit more detail about one particular example in this class of theories, which is a simple example that many of you probably know quite well. This is the example of the symmetric product orbifold, the SN orbifold, where you orbifold by the full permutation group. In this case, it's convenient to work with what we usually call the grand canonical partition function, where in addition to the chemical potential Q that is conjugate to the energy of the states in the theory, we introduce a chemical potential P that's conjugate to N. And then you can think about the grand canonical partition function, which is the generating function of all of the SN orbifolds, and was initially pointed out by Eric and a bunch of people who aren't here, so I don't have to remember their names. These grand canonical partition functions, in fact, have a lovely product formula for their density of states. So I just want to make one comment about this class of theories, which is that, as we all know, these partition functions are all individually modular invariant, under tau goes to minus 1 over tau, which gives us a Cardi formula. And this Cardi formula is valid when the central charge is fixed, but the dimension of the states that we're studying is large. But if you look at this product formula right here, and if you forget about that term right there, then this product formula looks like it's invariant when you switch P and Q. So it looks like it has a symmetry where you interchange the temperature with the chemical potential that's conjugate to N. And so because of that, in addition to having the usual modular symmetry, tau goes to minus 1 over tau, it has a different kind of modular symmetry where the chemical potential goes to minus 1 over the chemical potential. Now, I say almost here because there's a slight subtlety here, so one has to deal with that subtlety carefully. But at the end of the day, this almost invariance under mu to goes to 1 over mu also gives you a Cardi formula. And what is the Cardi formula you get from that? Well, it's the exact same Cardi formula that you got from the tau to 1 over tau symmetry.
The chemical potential of what?
It's the chemical potential that's conjugate to N, the number of copies of your CFD. So you get the same Cardi formula, but it has a different regime of validity. The original Cardi formula is valid for a fixed conformal field theory at large energy. The new Cardi formula is valid when you fix the energy minus the central charge, and you take the central charge to be large.
So in the geometry, this would be like adding another term to the first law of thermodynamics, which has
absolutely
variation in the...
Absolutely. This is adding a first law, another term to the first law of thermodynamics that is conscious. So if you think of the cosmological constant as a pressure, then this is, as say, as measuring the volume of space, then this is adding a pressure.
Or you could, but are you assuming you can continuously vary that?
I'm not. I'm just writing down this formula and looking at its consequences. Okay. So now, one of the things that we all learned, at least if your advisor was Andy Strominger, is that the Cardy formula is the thing that correctly reproduces the black hole entropy in three dimensions. But the question is, which of these Cardy formulas correctly reproduces the black hole entropy? Well, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy formula is supposed to be valid in the semi-classical limit for black holes that are large in Planck units. Whereas this Cardy formula is valid for quantum theories of gravity for black holes that are large in ADS units. In order to correctly reproduce the black hole energy for black holes that are large in Planck units, but small in ADS units, you instead need this dual kind of Cardy formula. And so correctly reproducing the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy.
Small in ADS units, you just mean not parametrically large.
Parametrically large. I mean order one in ADS units.
Order one, okay.
I mean correctly reproducing the black hole entropy for black holes that are large in ADS units is not very hard because areas scale like volumes in anti-de Sitter space. So we shouldn't be particularly impressed with that fact. You should be much more impressed if you can reproduce black hole entropy for black holes whose area is finite in ADS units. Okay. So more generally, we can ask whether there's an interesting physical interpretation, maybe getting back to Diehl's question, of this grand canonical partition function. So, for example, one question you could ask is, just as the tau to 1 over tau symmetry had a geometric interpretation as large conformal transformations on the torus, does this mu to 1 over mu symmetry have a geometric interpretation? Now, generally, it's very weird to think of a potential conjugate to the N, say, of SUN gauge theory. You know, that doesn't sound like something that we would study very often in the language of gauge theories. But if you think about Moldesena's original derivation of ADS-CFT, he derived ADS-CFT by thinking about a stack of D-brains and considering the stack of D-brains at fixed charge, at fixed Ramon-Ramon charge. So you could ask, what would happen if you tried to do ADS-CFT not at fixed Ramon-Ramon charge, but at fixed Ramon-Ramon potential? And that's something like the object that we're studying here.
So, Alex, this explains why this lesson is the explanation of why the Cardy formula becomes exact, even when you wouldn't expect it to.
That's correct. For this class of theories. I mean, I should also
mention...
Which
are not holographic.
It depends on what you mean by holographic. They certainly don't look like Einstein gravity plus matter.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. I mean, I should also mention that there's...
You can't do the same trick if we just crank up the coupling now, but we still have an N. So,
that's a good question. Don't
you still have the same class of theories at, let's say, strong coupling?
That's right.
Then you do the same trick?
Well, so you could try, for example, and look at the D1, D5 system at the overfold point, turn on one of these parameters that takes
you. Are you still going to have this modular invariance?
I don't know. That's a good question.
But we know that there are similar theories where the second card formula is supposed to fail as the net value work for us.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even in the class of orbifolds that I'm studying, I had to use the fact that I had a symmetric product here. For a general permutation orbifold, we certainly don't have this mu to 1 over mu symmetry, and I wouldn't necessarily expect this version of the Cardy formula at all.
But isn't this just the story about the growth of the density of states at low energy? I mean, you just look at the derivation of the Cardy formula and then,
You can either assume it doesn't grow too fast, or you can show it doesn't grow.
Because you know the spectrum.
That's right. I mean, I should also mention, there's the interesting work that Tom and Bogdan, not Floria, and Christoph Keller did, Bogdan Stoika, is that right? Okay, yeah. Where they also analyzed the conditions under which a Cardy formula would hold, delta minus C going down to, not too far from the black hole threshold. And in that case, they showed that that's related to some sparseness condition on the light spectrum. Good. Okay.
You're changing the asymptotic boundary conditions of ADS. That's not something you change. By changing N, you're going to change
that's right.
The, so it's not something you would do in quantum gravity at all, where you want to keep the asymptotic boundary conditions fixed. these, well, these things are not part of the same.
I mean, you can't stop him from taking the direct sum of the Hilbert space with different n, right?
Let me make one comment, which is that people who study black, like Castor and Trashin, already defined this ensemble just studying black hole physics in anti-de Sitter space. And they reinterpreted black hole entropy as black hole enthalpy, which is a quantity that you define in this ensemble where you're not at fixed cosmological constant.
Let's let Alex make whatever comments he wants to make in his final 2 minutes.
Okay. So in my final 2 minutes, I'll just mention one further intriguing question, which is, now that we're thinking about spaces of conformal field theories, we could try and ask, what fraction of conformal field theories are holographic in a large N limit? Okay. And so one simple family of conformal field theories that you could study is the set of free bosons on a lattice. You could imagine free bosons on n free bosons in Rn, modded out by some lattice. So you could try and study that the space of possible lattices. Unfortunately, all of those theories are going to be not holographic in the sense that the density of states increases too rapidly with n. But if you consider orbital folds of these theories, then it is possible to get theories that are holographic. So this is, in fact, a generalization of the family of permutation orbital folds that I was discussing before. You can think of a permutation orbital fold as the orbital fold of some lattice of free bosons, for example, by the set of permutations, which is some automorphism of the Zn lattice. So it turns out that if you want to keep the density of states finite in the large n limit, then what you're really looking for is a lattice whose automorphism group, the set of symmetries by which one could potentially orbifold, grows rapidly as a function of n. And it turns out that there's a lot of mathematical technology for counting lattices and for even estimating how many lattices, the fraction of lattices with certain kinds of automorphism groups. And it turns out that if one is interested in even self-dual lattices, the number of lattices is finite. It grows very rapidly with n. The fraction of those lattices with a sufficiently large automorphism group is factorially small in n. So you could possibly interpret this mathematical fact as telling you that in the space of possible conformal field theories, very few of them have holographic duals. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
On this slide, holographic dual includes things that have a Hagedorn spectrum.
Absolutely. In fact, I suspect that it includes nothing else.
Okay. So, something that I'm a little confused about here, in most of the concrete examples that we know that are holographic in the more strict sense, that the ADS radius is much bigger than the string scale, they have a large compact dimension and wouldn't satisfy your finiteness criterion.
They're a family of theories. Well, you could certainly consider theories where the size of the compactification radius stays finite as you take n to infinity, but I suppose you want to think about families where it grows with n.
Well, do you know any examples that are really well established where the radius stays finite?
Certainly the best studied examples are ones where the radius grows with n. I thought DeWolf and Friends had some examples.
DeWolf and Friends claimed that they could have a radius that grew with n, but more slowly than the ADS radius.
Right.
Okay. I personally don't think that's correct, but that's for me, still a controversial point. But even then, it grows with n.
Right.
So it wouldn't satisfy your criteria.
Do you believe in KKLT without the upfront?
No.
Not without the output?
Sorry?
Without the output.
Just the ADS
4 times the small Calabria.
Well, it certainly looks more reasonable without the output.
Let's have maybe one more question or comment.
Go for it. So there's another measure on this, I don't know if it's the same measure on the space of 2DS TFGs, which is the Zamolodnikov metric. Is that the same as this?
Implicitly, yeah. I mean, there's some statements about measure in order to make this statement, I have to use a particular measure, and I have to convince myself that it's the right measure. And the way I convince myself is observing that it's basically the Zamolodchikov measure.
The Zamolodchikov measure versus the Zamolodchikov measures, which will be only broken by the
I'm looking at a measure on a space of lattices. Okay, I'm counting the fraction of lattices which have this property that I could orbifold them. And the space of lattice is a continuous space, but I also said very quickly I was looking at even self-dual lattices, which are some discrete set of points, and I'm counting such lattices. But in the continuous moduli space of lattices, the moduli space of Durian compactifications, the automorphism group of a lattice.
Sorry, even self-dual, definite signature or indefinite?
Definite signature.
Oh.
Then the point is that you have to treat each of these lattices not as a point in that moduli space, but some sort of orbifold point. And the order of the orbifold is the size of the automorphism group.
Sorry.
I think we're going to move on to the second half of this talk.
It's an obvious statement if you think about it, but when I say it quickly, it sounds mysterious.
All right. Thank you very much.